and welcome to the Green Majority from Toronto. It's time for your weekly dose of conservation information here with a little bit of varied theme music this week. On behalf of CIUT 89.5 in Toronto and our fantastic community radio partners across the country, of course, I am your host, Darren Kaster, and welcome to the Green Majority. This week, we've got a special event. I'm not going to feel so lonely in the studio, a little bit of a rarity. I have two live guests that are going to be sitting next to me in the studio. First, we're going to be starting off at the beginning of the program with Andrew Knox, who will be talking about transition towns and how this applies to, in this case, Toronto, but a very general concept dealing with some big issues, things like peak oil and the need to sustainify, if you will, cities and towns and all across the country from really the ground up, if you will. So very appropriate for CIUT with the roots up approach. I think a very CIUT style conversation in the first half. Second half, we'll be speaking to Claire O'Connor. Claire O'Connor is going to be representing Tools for Change. So a lot of social activism theme this week. Tools for Change offers workshops in the Toronto area as far as activism. So we've got things like group decision making, organizing rallies and marches, how to deal with the media, this sort of thing. So if you're an interested activist or perhaps just want to know a little bit more about how the political system works and how to engage with it, you're going to want to stay tuned for her in the second half of the show. We're a little bit behind on our schedule, unfortunately, to do the headlines. So we're going to be joining headlines about halfway through the program. So we're going to jump right into the middle of it here. I've got Andrew Knox in the studio. Welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
Not too bad. So Good. Explain, why don't we start right at the top here? I know you've got an event coming up. We'll discuss that at the end of the interview, but we'll start right off at the top. What is a transition town?
Well, a transition town is any community in which there's a transition towns group active. There are lots in Canada, about 900 in the world, that are official, and maybe like 1,800 that are getting into the movement. The idea is just to move from oil dependency to local resilience. So right now, we're very dependent on oil. It's actually quite a daunting idea to say that we should use less fossil fuel because of the carbon emissions. The way that we live is so dependent on these fossil fuels still that it's not easy to imagine a positive future in which we've actually tackled the climate challenge and in which we are coping with the supply limitations that we have on fossil fuels. So transition towns are taking us from that place where we're dependent on oil and moving to what we like to call local resilience. It's local because if you're going to use a lot less oil, you've got to draw a pretty small radius around where you live and say that everything, or just about everything that I produce or consume, is going to have to happen in that radius. And when I say small, I mean, you know, small relative to today's globalized and fossil fuel powered economy. So that's why it's got to be local. And then resilience is this idea that you can withstand or absorb shock and continue to perform core functions. So what we're really looking to do in these transition communities is address the fact that we are in the transition period. You know, like we are on the second half of the fossil fuel curve. We're now, whether we want to or not, transitioning from a carbon-based economy to something else. So recognize that we're doing that, but also say, you know, we can maintain and possibly improve our standard of living if we start thinking about things on the community level. So let's start taking the actions that we need to take to get to that place where, you know, we are in the post-carbon economy and we have a functioning economy and we still have places that are enjoyable to live. It's not like a Mad Max scenario, right? We don't have to get into a Mad Max scenario. I don't think we will, but you can't just fall into a great community that is using a lot less fossil fuel. It takes a lot of active transition, and that's what we try to do in the Transition Towns movement.
Okay, so is it? I think the word transition in the name there implies a few different things, and one of them is that obviously you're not talking about building a city from scratch or building a town from scratch. This is a way to transfer one kind of an existing paradigm to a new kind of low carbon or no carbon paradigm, preparing for things like peak oil and this sort of thing, where these sorts of carbon-based fuels and whatnot are not going to be available. We're not going to have as many, you're not going to be able to, you know, import large amounts of items and this sort of thing because of the cost of shipping. So talk about some of the specific changes that might happen in a town. Maybe even you could start with some of the things that might be the easiest ones for someone to start with. If someone's listening and they're in a small town, they want to start some of these movement. What types of things would people do to implement this type of change?
Sure. Well, I mean, the first thing, and I think one of the easiest things, and a lot of people's sort of entry point into transition is local food, right? So Blake Poland is a professor here at the university. He lives in Oakville. He's a founder of Transition Oakville, and he has converted his lawn and the surrounding area, like sort of the non-building land that he's got on his property, into a garden that now produces thousands of pounds of vegetables per year. So he's being very successful with that. And as you pointed out, he's not like moving somewhere else and trying to start in a place where he's got more wild land to work with to grow food. He's saying, you know, what can I do with what I've got, a typical 1970s Oakville lot? How can I start, you know, making myself more resilient? Well, I can grow some of my own food. And that is a big, big deal. To borrow sort of a phrase from Chris Martinson, if you are 3% resilient, that's a lot better than 0% resilient. So just growing a little bit of his own food, and anybody doing that, and a lot of people are doing that, and obviously there's a huge local food movement, that fits very well with the sort of transition thinking. The other thing, or another major thing that a lot of transition towns do, is start using a local currency. And we actually have a Toronto dollar in Toronto. And I've got some in my wallet right now. And you can only spend them at local businesses in Toronto. And that's the idea with local currencies. You have to build your local economy, and you have to really respect and build up local business people, local entrepreneurs. Because as I say, like, if you have to have everything that you need to consume produced in a small radius, that means these entrepreneurs are the producers. Becoming one of them is a great thing you can do for transition. Obviously, you want it all to be sustainable, but again, you know, local production is a really big part, and local currencies make sure, you know, I've heard from the Toronto dollar people that you spend money in a local business, 42% of it stays in the community. Those business owners will hire local lawyers, local accountants, and just local suppliers even. Whereas, you know, you go to Walmart, you're lucky to get 5 cents staying in your community. So building the local business scene, patronizing local businesses, and, you know, doing some local business yourself, seeing yourself as less of a consumer, more of a producer is really useful. So those are two things. Another thing, just
actually, well, efficiency. Before you move on, actually, there's something I want to talk about. That, I mean, that seems the concept sounds very natural and makes a lot of sense. I'm interested to know, in a practical sense, I mean, you're talking about a kind of a smaller community where a lot of these original transition towns started. I think that's very easy to kind of envision people doing that sort of thing. But when you're talking about like we'll get to a little bit later with your event, where you're trying to implement some of these concepts into a place where they wasn't really sort of originally envisioned in the big city. You know, what is my immediate question would be, and I'm sure other people's as well, is what does Revenue Canada think of that? Like, how does this sort of thing actually, how does that function in practice with the kind of rules and regulations, and, you know, and other than being a concept, how does that really work?
So I haven't talked to Revenue Canada about
that. But you know, that type of concern that the people might have about, you know, how am I going to be able to do this? How is it going to be regulated? Counterfeiting, all that sort of thing. Like,
counterfeiting is actually something that the Toronto dollar has run into, and they've just started printing bills that are tougher to counterfeit. In a smaller town, I've never seen that happen. You're right to sort of point out, okay, so this is the whole movement is called Transition Towns. It was created in towns, and it actually, I think, works more readily in a town scale. You know, like the larger your community, the sort of more it takes to change the direction and get that attention on it. And obviously, you know, if you're in a smaller community, there's probably more land that isn't paved, and so local food works better. And maybe, you know, there already are a lot of local businesses for you to build up. There are a lot of local businesses in Toronto, and there are actually a lot of surrounding, you know, food producers and just people who produce stuff in Toronto. But the one of the major challenges here is scaling this up to a megacity scale. You know, like the event we'll talk about later is creating an Energy Descent action plan for Toronto. Energy Descent action plans are a central feature in transition towns, and they're basically saying, you know, you're going to have less energy over time. How do you roll with that? And as I say, maintain this standard of living. There's never been made an energy descent action plan for a mega city? So good question, and we're going to find out. I don't want to go too far into answering it because this is a really community-led movement, and I'm really hoping that at this event I get these answers from the people who live in Toronto. But if you are looking today to where our inroads are, as I say, there are lots of local businesses in Toronto. You can even change the way you think about local to think, you know, this is my neighborhood, my part of Toronto. There are hundreds of local neighborhoods in Toronto. How international trade and so on continues to go on at a place like the TSE in a transition scenario, I don't know if that's as much of an issue for transition towns to answer as it is for the TSE to say, you know, how does this even work in a post-carbon, you know, era? Like, one of the fantasies that I think a lot of people have and we try to address through transition is this idea of green tech stability. And that's the idea that everything will pretty much be the same, but we'll just have all of our energy coming from clean sources instead of fossil fuels. The reason that that's a fantasy is that there really isn't a replacement for fossil fuels. Renewable energy is awesome. And if we want abundant energy, that's where we've got to put our investment. But when I say abundant in respect to renewables, it's a very different thing from abundant with respect to fossil fuels. You can't have this 2% growth every year with something other than what has really been the miracle in a lot of respects other than environmental of fossil fuels. So I think the TSE and International Trade and Revenue Canada, they've all got to think, you know, how is our system going to work? And I don't really think that local communities need to concern themselves with that question as much as how is our community going to work and where's my food going to come from?
Absolutely. And I almost want to stick in a suggestion. I mean, obviously, as you said, this has to be something the community itself decides. But
yes.
I would think that something a fit that's more manageable than a megacity would be to start with things, something like local business associations. I know there's the Roncesvalles Business Association. And especially in a big city like Toronto, they've started kind of branding neighborhoods. And that almost kind of simulates the town aspect.
That's right. And so the business associations that we've got in Toronto are, I think, very strong. I think they're great contacts to start with, you know, and they do, like, there are a lot of organizations and people that are already doing transition in Toronto just by another name. Toronto is a great city for that. And those, looking to those business associations is a good step. They'll definitely support the same kind of things that we want to support in terms of developing the local economy.
Okay, so just getting back to a minute for the kind of origin of the ideas, the small things. Trying to think of things that, you know, when I'm thinking about, making eco-friendly cities or when I kind of envision that, or, you know, transition towns, I'm thinking like things just off the top of my head, like, you know, big solar panels and capital investments, things that cost lots of money. But you came with some ideas that are more like community aspects in the sense of this is just, you know, changing your lawn from a lawn to a garden. So is there any other examples you can give of like really easy to conceptualize things that aren't going to, you know, require people to go and get a bank loan to to implement?
I mean, we're doing a vermicomposting workshop on October 15th. You know, that's teaching people how to build containers so that they can do their own composting at home, and then that's good for their garden, you know. Things like just draft-proofing your house, you can do that for like $15 of silicone and go around your house. You know, and again, these are not new actions. That kind of thing has been going on, and there have been workshops for that kind of, you know, just home energy efficiency and whatever in Toronto for years. But that is something that, I would say, fits with the transition kind of mentality. You don't have to spend a lot of money to do these things. If you're looking at energy efficiency is the first thing to do, and draft proofing and that kind of stuff is not very expensive. If you're looking to do, you know, renewable energy systems, those can be expensive, but you can look at things like developing a cooperative. And that's what's so great about having a transition group. You can easily find like-minded people that might want to be investing in that. In fact, one of our former steerers is the president of ZooShare, which is a biogas cooperative that's working out of the Toronto Zoo, right? So I think that when you get into the things that do require big capital expenditures, the community aspect and the cooperation aspect of this is really how that kind of thing is going to be financed. A lot of transition towns internationally have started their own energy companies. And so, you know, it's not that those things are not being addressed. those are just expensive things are harder to do on your own. Mm-hmm. But that is basically the way of this transition, right? That one of the great benefits and one of the reasons we say that we can retain our standard of living despite lower energy availability is that we will have to, out of practicality, rely on each other. And that builds community. You know, humans are social animals. But because of fossil fuels, I can sit in my apartment and order everything I want over the internet, and I don't even have to meet the delivery person at the door, right? In a transitioned economy, you're already going to be working together on people that will be willing to cooperate with you and invest with you in an expensive thing like a solar panel or a wind turbine.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, one of my personal examples, I just recently moved housing situations, and there's a gentleman upstairs who's retired who does nothing but kind of, you know, relax and play in the garden, but also he walks around to, like, garage sales and things and whatnot. And I can, you know, I'm in a thing where I'm busy, I still have school, and I have work, and I do the show and do all these things. And so every time I need something, I'm like, okay, well, I better stop by the store and buy it. And since I've moved in, he's just like, you know, let me know if you need anything. And he keeps finding this stuff for free. And I've gotten, like, you know, I've probably in the last month and a half saved maybe, like, $200 or $300. Mm-hmm. Just from this guy just like going and buying stuff for like a dollar at like a garage sale just because I don't have the time. But I mean, that's the sort of community that you're talking about.
Exactly.
Is, you know, hey, you need that. Can I borrow your shovel rather than going and buying a new one and everything?
And so you see like, okay, we might be thinking about less GDP because, again, that's dependent on fossil fuels and continued exploitation of those, less economic activity. But if you don't need as much of that because you're sharing and you're getting things for free, you know, then as I say, you're going to retain that standard of living. You're going to have what you need. You're just not going to, as you say, go to the store and buy it. One of our major projects we're developing now is an East End tool library. So that's a place where, you know, if you need to do some work, you think you get paid to do whatever, but you don't have the tools to do it, you can come to the library, borrow it. You don't have to buy it, and someone else can keep using it. You get more use out of the tool, and it's exactly what you're talking about. It's, you know, community sharing, pulling together, and making sure we can keep doing the business that we need to do to make Toronto a great place to live.
Well, and I think, and that's something that I'd like to stick on a little bit further, because I think that is something that comes up, people saying, well, you know, how do you address this sort of issue? And yes, you know, overconsumption, for instance, is a hot topic. We talked about it a lot last week. And one of these issues was, so, okay, well, you know, in theory, yes, it's great to share everything and, you know, everybody likes getting something for free. But, you know, what are you going to do if nobody's spending any money on anything, then the whole economy collapses and we don't have jobs? And I would say, well, no, because, I mean, one of the options here, I mean, to give an example would be that, you know, perhaps I get a free pair of shoes. So instead of buying two a year, I buy one. And but because I have that money left over, instead of buying a $12.99 pair from, you know, a discount superstore, you know, we don't want to pick on anybody specifically here, but
sure.
Instead of buying a $12.99 pair that was made in Taiwan or in China or something, I can afford to go to the local leather maker and have a nice pair or whatever, or if you're anti-leather, you know, or whatever, but, you know, spend the additional money. Yes, you know, local goods that are handmade do cost more, but if you're buying less things less often, you can afford to do that. And again, like you're saying, that money can stay in the community. You still exactly. have an economy, even if you're not buying things every week.
No, and that is good for the economy, right? Rather than sending your $12.95 to Sam Wallman and he sits there hoarding it, you know, you can cycle that money through your economy a lot more if you're doing exactly as you say. And the other thing to point out too is, like, it's not that people buying less stuff will cause the collapse of the economy. You've already seen that we've been in a very long recession that followed $150 a barrel oil. You know, oil being expensive will do that to the economy. And the question, it's sort of looking at it the opposite way, right? Not how is our spending going to affect the economy, but how is this economy going to affect what we can afford to spend money on?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's more that you've got to think about it from on that question top down. Right.
Okay, so we've gone through a whole bunch of the ideas. Perhaps, as I said, you know, this is a national program. We're here doing this in Toronto, but we've got listeners all across the country here. Do you have any examples of other transition towns or other movements that are going on across the country that maybe people could look up in their local area?
Absolutely. So, I mean, there are too many for me to name in one radio show in Canada. Last I knew, there were 13 official in Ontario, but there's Alberni Valley, BC, Boucherville, Quebec. I know I'm friends with Sylvie from Postcard Montreal. They're into transition there. Cambridge, Ontario, Edmonton has one. Guelph, Kelowna, Nelson, Oakville, as I mentioned. Peterborough, Salt Spring Island, Victoria, Vancouver, and Woodstock, New Brunswick. They're really all over. And there are like several of them. And a lot of them are happening in smaller communities where it's easier to sort of make the shift. It's easier to get people's attention. And you know, I used to work in England, and I knew this group of 48 people, this town of 48 people, 100% of them were into the transition movement, right? Now, in a city like Toronto, I'm lucky to have a steering committee of 4 people. And I really mean that. They're cool people. I'm very lucky, right? But
it's just that there's only 4 of them. It's
there's
not,
only
not
four.
Awesome.
If I had the same percentage as that community from England, you know, 100% of the people in Toronto into transition, we would have already done it and we'd be very happy, right? Mm. But yeah, they're all over the place. And I think maybe one of the reasons they're happening more in smaller communities is that this was created as the Transition Towns movement. And I've still got a lot of work to do thinking about how to apply that in Toronto. But they're, yeah, all over the country. There's no, you know, if you don't have one in your community, there's not much to starting one, and there's no sort of legal barrier to doing that.
Mm-hmm.
You can just check out the Transition Handbook. Actually, if you email me at transitiontoronto@gmail.com, I'll send you a PDF of the Transition Handbook. And there you go. You start from there. The handbook actually just tells you right out, like, this is what you do step by step.
So the idea, and basically when we're talking about the original thing, is towns, and this is the, as you said, it's like building a sense of community. And when you do things like, you know, because anyone can go out and, oh, I want to save a couple bucks, so I'll say, you know, seal up my house so I don't spend as much on heating and cooling.
Yeah.
The difference between doing that sort of thing in a transition town is that you kind of go to your neighbors and say, hey, I'm going to do this, you do this too, and I'll help you do yours if you help me do mine.
Yeah.
And that then you do everything together, so that once you've gotten through those easy steps, like planted all the, you know, maybe taken a section of the local park if you happen to have that space and turn into a community garden, and these sorts of things, that, you know, once you've kind of gotten used to working together on the easy things, you can then get to a place where you are potentially, you know, pitching in 50 people to pitch in for some solar panels for the local
yes.
community or something like that. But
well,
that's a later step, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So there are these 12 ingredients of transition, and the last one is just let it go where it wants to go. By the time you've done enough of the small steps, you should have a strong organization and the experience to start tackling larger projects, which is what we need to do. So, of course, the earlier you start, the better. Now, There's a sort of a saying that is in this other book, The Transition Companion, that says, you know, if we wait for governments to do this, it'll be too little, too late. If we act as individuals, it'll be too little. But if we can act as a community, we might be able to do this in time. So there is this, you know, you can seal up your house and save a few bucks, but you definitely want to sort of bring that to the community, or just, you know, a lot of transition towns start at a movie showing. You know, you show End of Suburbia, which was directed by Toronto director Greg Green. That tells people about peak oil, and it sort of inspires people to say, I've got to do something about this. You know, when you get enough people like that, then you may have your steering committee, and you may just start going from there.
Sure. And, you know, I mean, there's that kind of axiom that a lot of people say or use as, I guess, an excuse to not do anything, is that one person can't take a difference, or this, you know, one vote can't change anything. And it's like, well, that's only true if that one person lives in a vacuum. You know, if that
yeah.
person has friends and family and any sense of community, and obviously they're interested enough to do it, and they just tell them about it, then yes, you know, hey, I did it isn't just like, it's really good idea to seal up your house, but hey, I sealed up my house, it was really easy. They can go, really? Oh, well, you know, did you actually save money? Yeah, totally. Was it really easy to do? Absolutely. Totally. So in that sort of sense, these sort of thing.
You know,
yeah, it's, you know, one person can make a difference because it has a ripple effect, right?
Completely, yes.
So we've only got a couple of minutes left, Andrew. I don't want to skip any time to talk about your event. So
sure.
Why don't you tell us what's coming up here in Toronto?
Yeah, so it's, as you say, like getting into starting bigger projects. I kind of felt I was at a point with Transition Toronto that things were going along in the routine, that now it's time to ask some people from Toronto, you know, what should we do next, and what should we do on a bigger scale? So the event is called Energy Descent Action Theater. It's not a theater thing in the sense that people are on stage with a script. It is it is a drama-based, arts-based kind of consultation where we, through these drama games, guide the audience into making an energy descent action plan for Toronto. An energy descent action plan is a plan that says, you know what, over time, we're going to have less energy available. How do we do this? How do we make sure that our communities are still good places to live? Even though, and possibly because, we're making this transition to a post-carbon world. So the event is October 21st. It's at St. Paul's, Trinity St. Paul's Center, 427 Bloor Street West. It's going to be really fun. Fun is a big part of it, because we've got to keep people creative and collaborative, get them in a good, you know, headspace to get some really outside-the-box ideas on how Toronto and Toronto communities are going to make this transition. And then afterwards, because we will have created the first megacity scale energy descent action plan, and we really will have set the ball rolling for a meaningful transition in Toronto away from fossil fuels, you know, living within a responsible carbon budget and an available carbon budget. We will celebrate by serving everyone cake. So you can see
I'm the, there, Andrew. Yeah. You just convinced me.
There you go. So, the cake is part of the fun, and the celebrating is really important. A hallmark of transition is remaining positive, because all of these sort of negative scenarios can drive people's heads into the sand, and this isn't what that's about. We just want normal people from Toronto to come and say, you know, what do I like about my community? What do I really want to retain if I envision this community in the future as a positive place to live? And how do we do that within our energy budget? And how do we, you know, trim the fat? How do we get rid of the stuff that we can't afford and don't mind missing?
Absolutely. And I mean, this is, like you're saying too, this isn't an event where, you know, you're asking people to come with a, you know, serious attitude, and it's not, if for the type of person that maybe isn't the type of person that wants to go and wave signs, yes, or whatever, this is a community meeting, a chance to meet people. It's all about generating a community.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. Working together, you know, taking control of our city's energy future. And it isn't going to be that serious. I'm not going to turn away experts. I like experts, and that's cool, but you definitely don't have to be an expert in any of these areas. I think that experts are the people that got us into the trouble we're in right now. All I want is people who, you know, can think creatively and love their communities and love their cities and want to see it continue on this trajectory of a better and better place to live. And October 21st, 2:30, Trinity St. Paul's. Lots of fun. You can buy tickets for $9.70 in advance at Eventbrite. It's energydescentactiontheater.eventbrite.ca, or you can pay at the door. Then it'll be $12. You can also RSVP on Facebook or on the Transition Toronto website in the events section.
Absolutely. So if you're in Toronto, please come and attend Andrew's event at Transition Toronto, of course. If you're not in Toronto, as Andrew was saying before as well, there are transition towns all across the country. If you don't have one in your neighborhood, I'm sure Andrew would be more than happy to give you information to help start one or start one of these conversations. So do you want to give your email one more time before we go here?
Yeah, it's transitiontoronto@gmail.com. I can send you the transition handbook. Also, Energy Descent Action Theater is a replicable event that has been done in a couple of towns in the UK. So I can send you all the material you need to make your own town's energy descent action plan.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Again, that was Andrew Knox with Transition Town and the Transition Toronto Energy Action Descent Action Theater. There we are.
Energy
Thanks very
descent
much.
Descent Action Theater.
There we go. All right.
We're
going to take
much.
A quick music break and we'll be right back with some headlines. Stay tuned. All right, and we are back. I'm Darren Kaster. You are listening to The Green Majority. Of course, you can find us online right now at Facebook. Is kind of our main outlet at the moment, while our website is down. However, I've been saying that for quite some time. I would also like to announce that we will be relaunching in probably, I would say, a couple of weeks, not just the original website, but with a brand spanking new, shiny new website with all sorts of new features. I've invested some of my personal finances to get us a fancy new website and all that sort of stuff. So stay tuned for that. Unfortunately, as I said, the website is down currently, but stay tuned for a shiny new website with all sorts of new fun stuff, including hopefully very, very soon, but I don't have a date for it, some video content. Very exciting, so stay tuned for that. You can send us some comments or suggestions if you like at thegreenmajority@gmail.com. For the time being, as I said, interact with us. Feel free to interact with us at our Facebook fan page. And of course, we have our Twitter feed, which is at Green Majority. We've, for the time being, have just been putting out a list to the headline. Well, I shouldn't say just. It's a great resource, but... we've been putting out headlines as far as the stories that we consider for our headlines and links to all those stories. So it's basically a feed of Canadian and international news stories. However, between Leah and I, we're going to try and commit to actually putting out personal posts of that as well. So updates on just things from the show. So please join us at Green Majority on the Twitter feed as well. And all sorts of other fun stuff will be coming up. Stay tuned. We've got a lot in the works here. I can't exactly tell you what it is just yet, but you should be on the edge of your chair if you're not already. However, in the meantime, we're going to go to Leah Mazzolini with the international headlines.
Thanks, Darren. A leading climate change expert is calling on worldwide nuclear power station binge to avoid irreversible global warming. Cambridge University professor of ocean physics Peter Wadhams says intensive research into advanced geoengineering as well as major increase in nuclear power is crucial. He adds that both potential solutions have inherent dangers but are now vital as time is running out. Wadham proposes that the use of thorium-fueled reactors being tested in India, which experts say to be safer because they don't result in proliferation of weapons-grade plutonium. Also, under certain circumstances, the waste of thorium reactors is less dangerous and remains radioactive for hundreds rather than thousands of years. The Cambridge professor is also the head of the Polar Oceans Physics Group at the university and has returned from a field trip to Greenland. His evidence pointed to the Arctic sea ice cover reached a record low this summer, with a rate loss of 50% higher than most scenarios outlined by other polar scientists. According to a new study, a small aquatic animal may be on the front lines of the battle against climate change. Sea otters are keeping sea urchins' populations in check, which in turn allows carbon dioxide-loving kelp to prosper. Researchers from the University of California, Santa Cruz, have been looking at 40 years of data on otters and kelp blooms on the North American coast as far north as the Alaskan Islands. They say that they found that sea otters have a positive indirect effect on kelp biomass by preying on sea urchins. Sea urchins overconsume kelp when otters aren't present. However, predators cause urchins to hide in crevices, causing them to eat just the plant scraps. Kelp is particularly good at capturing carbon through photosynthesis, pointing to less carbon dioxide in the air. The authors of the study acknowledge that otters probably aren't the answer to rising greenhouse gas levels, but say that their study illustrates the impact animals can have on the atmosphere. According to U.S.-based climate scientists, there are sole targets to organized harassment of skeptics when it comes to global warming. Director of the Yale Project of Climate Change Communication, Tony Lizerowitz, says that the evidence of the U.S. public also being misled. He says that ClimateGate, the 2009 hacking of emails from the Climatic Research Unit in the U.K., had a significant impact on public opinions. U.S. skeptics were accusing the emails written by Michael Mann, director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University, as evidence that he and others were overstating the human influence on global warming. In a soon-to-be-published Yale study, nearly 13% of on-the-fence Americans in 2010 said ClimateGate reduced their trust in climate science and in scientists. And that's all for the international news. I'm Leah Mazzolini.
Thank you very much, Leah. And we'll hopefully, as I said, once that website is back up, start posting those news stories again. But in the meantime, please do join our Twitter feed. We've got, we just broke 225, actually. We're going to be, I'm looking for 300 sooner than later as possible. Again, as I said, stay tuned for new website, new media, putting out website videos, all sorts of cool things. You might get to see what some of us look like, not just our voices soon. We'll see how that goes. We'll see how it goes. In the meantime, we're going to now go to Claire O'Connor, who's joining us from Tools for Change. Welcome to the program, Claire.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
So do you want to just outline exactly what it is that Tools for Change does?
Sure thing. So we're going into our third year, and Tools for Change is an annual workshop series for activists, new and experienced, designed to help them cultivate their skills and hone their skills to be more effective in political organizing. It's a joint project between the Ontario Public Interest Research Group here at U of T, OPIRG, and Earthroots and Greenpeace. And it's a very exciting project. We're all really proud of it, toolsforchange.net.
Okay, and so like, give us an idea of like what sorts of programs here. I mean, I've got a list of some of them. They kind of outline things like meeting and how to organize rallies and how to talk with politicians and that sort of thing. Do you want to give us some detail just about the specific types of programs that you guys do?
Sure. I mean, maybe it's good to start with the premise of the series, which is that we believe first that political movements are really necessary for garnering public support for any number of changes that'll be useful for all of us. And what we know from experience is that you learn any number of skills through the course of doing the work. And most people who have done some political activism will say, you know, I've learned so much more doing this than I have in classes and stuff like this. And you do kind of get thrown into the deep end and have to learn things quickly. And in those moments, you can develop skills, but it's very useful to have a kind of a different space within which to break them down to their different pieces and think through how to teach them, how to train people who are new to your group and stuff like that. And so the workshops range in topic. I'm sure you have some version of a list in front of you, and all of them are available on the website, and we post them and you can register in advance. And they do range from things like public speaking, which is often a really particular skill that, you know, certain people in a group will become very good at and then be expected to do all the time. And we want more people to be able to practice these things because they help us learn about the world. They help us become more effective independently. Mm-hmm. So that's one workshop that we host. And then there are things that are a little less, less exciting or less about the spotlight, like meeting facilitation. Everybody knows that political organizing involves hundreds of meetings, and you have to have really talented facilitators to get the most out of those discussions.
I was going to say that's one of the things where maybe you could explain a bit more about. You started to touch on it there, but what I'm definitely interested in is like the idea of like why exactly would someone need this sort of thing? Like, for instance, I noticed one of them was how to talk to the media. So, you know, what sort of troubles would your average person have when they're talking to the media, and why might they need to go to one of these workshops?
Right. I mean, I think that one of the things everybody needs to develop as they're trying to take action on a particular issue is a kind of clear sense of purpose. And that isn't something we want to just feed to one another. We want everybody to be able to come to their own terms around those things. And so being able to talk about training and workshops like this as a forum within which not to talk about a specific political line, but about a method for developing a political message, I think is really, really valuable. So in talking to the media, I mean, knowing how media work is really important as a starting point. You have to understand the risks of manipulation, the risks of, you know, going into a debate or an interview with somebody who's not as sympathetic as you are, for example.
I was going to actually jokingly volunteer to attend that and be like the practice dummy as the media, but then I realized that I'm actually a bad example of the media because I'm both informed and interested.
You are very unusual.
most aspects of the media is not, which is a good reason to stay tuned to the Green Majority all the time. But
of course.
So let's give me another example of something where people would find a practical skill to actually come to a workshop.
Well, just to elaborate on the media one, I mean, one thing that every political group, organizing group I've ever been a part of has been required to do is produce press releases mm-hmm. and report in text on their work. And writing is a really difficult skill, and specifically writing for people who are going to spend several seconds looking at the first several lines of your press release, that's a really impressive skill. And so being able to bring people in who have developed accuracy and efficiency and an ability to be really concise and use language that will captivate without, you know, neglecting the human nature, like human reality of the problem, is really important. And I think, I mean, I run a workshop called Political Writing as part of the series. And in that workshop, again, we talk about methods of approaching problems in text. So what do we do when, you know, we need to substantiate our claims and we want to be really comprehensive and fair and accurate, but we don't want to be seduced by, you know, conventional notions of balance, right? Mm-hmm. Where we want to be very honest about inequality.
And I think a good example that I think the widest possible audience would be familiar with would be to reference stuff like the Occupy movement and sure. stuff that was happening, where a lot of the time where fallbacks, whether you're talking about press releases or speaking to the media or whatnot, was that you have people who are not necessarily informed on the issues and they're just looking for the soundbite. And so mm-hmm. if you have someone where I've had some experience where if you go and try and, you know, someone asks you, so, you know, why are you here or why do you care about this issue? Why is this important? And you start into some long diatribe. They either cut you off or they don't use the clip if they do let you finish,
right.
Because they can't publish that. They're not going to, no matter how informed or eloquent you might be, they're not going to put a 20-minute clip of you speaking on the news. They're looking for something that they can clip out. And I don't think that it's as intentional as maybe some people conspiratorially think, but mm-hmm. when you're looking for something to put in the news, a lot of the time it's more interesting as far as their ratings to put on a clip of someone throwing a Molotov cocktail than it is to put right. a 20-minute or you know, try and find a 3-second mm-hmm. clip that's usable of someone's very well thought out and very well presented thing. So some of the skills that you're talking about here would be to, like, how to have a concise point that they might actually put on the news and
right.
things like that.
That would be really consequential. I mean, I don't think it's a conspiracy. I'm a proponent of, you know, Herman and Chomsky's manufacturing consent. I think people participate in media in a very nuanced, you know, somewhat innocent way. And so the question from the perspective of political strategy is, as you say, how to get the message out there, but how to make it the right one that isn't just about being palatable for people. So I think another workshop that we host that pertains to this and perceptions of your organizing is our direct action training. Mm-hmm. And direct action is, of course, a really important way to deliver a message that is simultaneously clear. You know, you can have a banner that makes it really, you know, you have a photo shot of a banner that illustrates or explicitly cites your points or your demands. But then the act itself demonstrates the degree to which you're going to be persistent and you're going to be confrontational until certain injustice is addressed.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's another aspect as far as conflict to get into. One of the other workshops I see here is group decision making.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the other issues that I'm aware that can come up frequently is when you're dealing with a large group of people. I mean, again, the Occupy is a really good example, but mm-hmm. this applies to any movement a lot of the time. Is you have a bunch of, generally when you're talking about direct action type people, the type of people that go to that, you're generally talking about very passionate sort of people. So I would think that, because that's not, you know, I tend to prefer to be behind the mic than necessarily on the street, but I would tend to think that there would be a high potential for intergroup conflict and just as far as messaging and choosing how to go about doing that message, what exactly to do. So this is something else you'd agree with that
absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, I mean, sometimes it's conflict, but the best case scenario, again, is that everybody has taken the time outside, beyond the content, to think through the best methods for communicating with one another. That is, when you have a clear set of objectives, that is, you want to prevent a logging company from invading effectively an indigenous community's land, and you want to participate in that as someone who lives in a nearby city and doesn't know the indigenous culture. How do you carefully think through those number of constraints and, with, you know, care and deliberation, build a strategy that satisfies everybody and simultaneously is likely to achieve your political objectives? It's very challenging, and when you see skillful people do it, it's noticeable. You know, it's inspiring. So, you know, one way to put it is to imagine that there are these reduced kind of positions or inclinations, and I'm not I don't prefer the spotlight either, like you. But I do think we should avoid the caricatures, because really what happens in those meetings is that you learn people are extremely – have an equal complexity as the political question itself in terms of their preferences around political action.
Absolutely. And I think finally, we only have about two minutes left, but I think one last thing that I wanted to ask as well is that, I mean, some of the groups that you said here that are participating, among others, you said the Earth Roots and Greenpeace and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
These, I want to sort of ask you about the idea about, because you're talking about things like very practical things, like how to organize a march and how to organize a rally. The types of groups that are involved, like Earth Roots and Greenpeace, obviously have very specific opinions on very specific issues. So you wouldn't, would you or would you not say that these, there's not like a tone towards like a specific outcome here. These are just general skills for anybody. So potentially someone who is completely opposed to Greenpeace's ideas could go and still take value from these things. Like I'm basically getting at, they're not kind of teaching or insisting on a certain message. These are just literally just skills workshops.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Exactly.
Okay.
And I mean, it's very, the reason that we launched this program was because we felt like there really wasn't an equivalent in Toronto, where it's useful to get involved with a group where you already kind of identify with the political message and project. But the ability to then hone a method and then do independent stuff, launch your own things, is limited. And so it's certainly the case that we don't have any clear political line in any of the workshops. The people who come in to facilitate are often very honest, though, about where they're coming from, their how they're situated, and what their politics are. And I think that's important. Like, it is a political workshop series. People shouldn't come expecting that there won't be discussion of politics, but it will be at that register of method. How do we break things down and learn how to share these skills? And I think that it's one thing that we just don't have a lot of time to do in our political organizing, in the rush from one crisis to the next.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. Absolutely. So in closing here, just as you said, you were talking about, this is a Toronto group doing some Toronto workshops. Are you aware of or have any information about or information on how to start maybe some of these ideas elsewhere in Canada? We're a national program. So if someone's sitting in BC, is there somewhere else maybe in across the country that people can get information about this sort of thing?
That's a really good question. We have on our website, and I'm not prepared with a good list, on our website, a list of allies and equivalent programs in Canada and the US and elsewhere. And so I would just recommend people visit our site and check out those links. It's toolsforchange.net. You can also register for the upcoming series for 2012-2013. There are going to be about 18 workshops, which is really exciting.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Claire O'Connor, again, representative of Tools for Change Toronto.
Thank you.
All right, so we're going to have one more music break, and we're actually going to speak to a long-lost soul. Kevin Farmer, believe it or not, actually still exists and will be in the studio. Stay tuned right after this. Oh, and we are back. This is Darren Kaster wrapping up the Green Majority here with the last few minutes. We've got Kevin Farmer live, warm body in the studio. How's it going, Kevin? Long time no see. Your time's cooled off a little bit, so it's glad that you'll be hopefully joining us regularly once again for a little while. But I understand that you came prepared with a topic today. So what did you want to talk about?
Well, what leapt out at me this week was an article in the Star concerning the fact that Jean Chrétien is co-chairing a council of former world leaders and experts trying to alert the UN Security Council, mind you, the Security Council, to the looming water crisis and what that means geopolitically. It's not so much the focus of the council isn't necessarily environmental; it's geopolitical, but it's a vital environmental issue. Some experts have been saying for quite some time that we'll be going to war over water long before we will be going to war over oil. And in general, I think this is timely for several reasons, and one of them is just that people have no idea how bad the water crisis really is. We already divert 50% of all freshwater resources exclusively to human usage, and the consumption of freshwater is growing at more than twice the rate of human population, which in the upshot of which means that by the middle of this century, we, in order to function as a society, as a human society, a collection of human societies, we will need 100% of the Earth's freshwater resources in order to sustain ourselves, which of course can't happen. Long before you've diverted every last drop of freshwater to your own exclusive use, you've seen catastrophic environmental collapse. I believe in the article, or maybe another article that I was reading on the same topic, the projection was that within 20 years, which is a tick in the clock when you're talking about human population growth, in 20 years we need to find the equivalent of 20 more Nile rivers, and there just isn't 20 more Nile rivers. There just isn't, and in fact, to exacerbate things, the freshwater supply for much of the world is disappearing in the form of melting glaciers. I believe most of the freshwater in Southeast Asia, it comes from melting glaciers, and when they're gone, that's millions upon millions of people who are now deprived of a source of fresh water. And you've got certainly between nuclear rivals India and Pakistan, you've got two very tense neighbors who don't need any other excuses for animosity or aggression. And you can find access to water. The issue of access to fresh water is also an exacerbation in the Jewish and Palestinian. I don't know what to call that without sounding very political, but problem, crisis.
I think we can go as far as crisis. I'll back you on that.
Yeah, it's a timely warning. They're not calling on the UN to take action, but it's significant that they're trying to alert the UN Security Council to the fact that this is, you know, this is actually a geopolitical issue, and that it will, you know, the looming water crisis will unquestionably destabilize regions of the planet and cause political strife and perhaps outright aggression in the case of warring over access to fresh water. And you can see the signs quite easily today.
Well, I think one of the most telling issues, and this wasn't specifically in relation to water issues, this is in relation to climate change, but, you know, considering all the, you know, nonsense that we've been hearing, especially from, you know, various U.S. Media agencies, I mean, it happens all over the world, but some of the most kind of avid denial of climate change was coming from things like, you know, Fox News and this sort of stuff.
Right.
But very quietly government agencies like the CIA, for instance, have been already sending reports to the president that are publicly available, but they do it kind of quietly, acknowledging that yes, climate change is real and we're concerned about it and trying to, you know, lobby the government to take it seriously because we see it as a major security issue. And I think that's, you know, when you have the EPA, I mean, I think the EPA is an excellent agency. It could be strengthened, but it's certainly not a useless agency. But if you have the EPA, as far as public concern puts out, it's like, okay, well, they're the environment agency. Of course they would say that. Right. But no, the CIA is saying it. And, you know, and the military, like people in the Pentagon are saying, this is a serious issue we actually need to take seriously.
Well, the Pentagon reported to the Bush administration that climate change was a national security issue and that they were planning, coming up with contingency plans for the geopolitical disruption that climate change was likely to bring. And this was this was a report to an administration that was certainly one of the greatest climate change deniers of all time.
Well, I think we could probably do a whole show on that. But again, did you want to just quickly reference the group again, if people were interested in looking that up?
I'm sorry to say I forgot the name. I think it's the Intercouncil. If you Google Jean Chrétien and UN and water, I'm sure you'd find it. I'm pretty sure it's called the Intercouncil.
Okay, well, that is all the time we have for, though. Welcome back to the program, Kevin Farmer. Technical production today was by Ryan Knight. Web hosting and bandwidth for our podcast is provided by the web consulting firm rjgcreative.com, with web production by Arlie Crawford. You can get an audio copy of today's program or transcript in the future of our news headlines, as always, at the brand spanking new, as soon as it gets released, greenmajority.ca. You've been listening to The Green Majority, Canada's all-environmental news hour. The program is produced live every Friday at CIUT and is available on campus and community stations from coast to coast. I'm Darren Kaster, and that's it for today's live edition. Until next week, thanks for listening.